Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. We are still working on the Gospel of Thomas. I beg your patience as we wait for people to come into the Zoom meeting, and we'll begin in just a moment. Hello, Sue.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. It's a nice sunny day and it's not too hot.
It is lovely. It is lovely. Okay.
Am I the first one?
You are.
Oh, that's most unusual.
Jeanette is out of town this week, and I don't know where anyone else is. So we'll see who else comes and give them a minute. And if not, we will just begin, and it will be a delightful conversation. How are you doing this morning?
Pretty good, all things considered. It's been a marathon of a week. So after today, I have a couple quieter days, which maybe I'll collect my wits again. Mm-hmm. We had an interesting book discussion group yesterday for the Breast Cancer Network. I did it from Zoom, but the other ones were at the network. There we go. Somebody's coming. It was on the Four Winds. Mm-hmm. And several of the people in the group, it's just a very small group, but several people had been teachers or counselors in the Buffalo schools, mm-hmm. and were acquainted or personally knew quite well people that had been killed Saturday.
Oh.
So it's been exhausting. You know, mm-hmm. just listening to the news is exhausting, but then when you listen to people who knew people, mm-hmm. it makes it even more real.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Good morning, Grace. How are you doing today?
Good, yourself?
I'm well, thank you. I'm well.
And Sue?
I'm good, thank you. It's hard not to be good when the sun comes out and the temperatures aren't in the 90s.
Well, I would like to be a little warmer, Sue.
Oh, do you? Sorry about that. I'm always happy on these days.
Grace, are you back from Florida? Or are you still in Florida?
No, I've been back since the end of April.
Oh, my goodness. I understand why you're a little surly about the weather then.
Yeah, you know, yesterday they put our awning up, but I can't sit out there because it's too cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the wind yesterday was really strong.
My grandson and granddaughter's softball and lacrosse games, and I'm sitting out there freezing my buns off.
Yeah.
Yep. That yep. sounds about right.
Yeah, the wind was cold.
Where is everybody this morning?
Well, just wondering.
There we go. There's Marilyn.
There's Marilyn.
Hurrah! And Jeanette is not going to be with us this morning because she is traveling.
What is wrong with Jeanette? I mean, she's been out a couple of weeks now. Is she like...
No, she's traveling.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you say...
No, I'm sorry. Last week she was sick. This week she's traveling.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we take a look at our first reading for today? It is from saying number 19. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome.
Hi. Welcome.
We're on saying 19. Would anyone like to read it out for us?
Well, sure, I can read it.
Great, Grace. Go ahead.
Jesus said, "Blessed is the one who came into being before coming into being. If you become my disciple and listen to my message, these stones will become your servants, because there are five trees in paradise which don't change in summer, winter, and their leaves don't fall. Whoever knows them won't taste death."
Okay, let's let that sink in for a couple moments of silence. What do you make of saying 19, friends?
Went awfully quickly from trees to stones and no explanation there.
Yes, and to be before existing.
Yes, stones to do.
It's like riddles.
Yes, yes. It's definitely, he's saying things without saying them.
Yes.
Whatever it is he's trying to convey, he's doing it in code.
So was there a historic reason for protection that they did this, or was this just the style of teaching?
That's a great question. There is a historic reason, and that is that in Jesus's time, as well as, oh, let me think, up through maybe the 1900s, maybe. So for a huge swath of our recorded history, whatever region you were in and whatever religion either dominated in that region or whatever religion you were participating in, you weren't allowed to say things that seemed to contradict the established rules of the tradition of the religion, whether it was one that was yours or not, on pain of death in many places. And the tricky thing about Judaism in the time of Jesus is that it had a lot of rules, but it wasn't allowed to carry out some of them on its own authority because it had a Roman overlord. And so the Roman overlord, not just in Palestine, but in all the territories that it was in, it set up puppet kings who were client kings, and it set up governors. And it largely let the people rule themselves, except for a few important little details. And one of the important little details was that the only authority that was allowed to execute other people was Rome. So the Jews may rule themselves in Palestine with the Herodian monarchs, but all of their death penalties have to be okayed by the Roman governor, which is why the Jewish authorities needed Rome to crucify Jesus, because they couldn't actually kill him for blasphemy. And the thing is, the traditional punishment before the Romans came along for blasphemy was to be stoned to death. So Jesus had plenty of good reason to hide, if he did saying 19 in the Gospel of Thomas, he had plenty of reason to hide what he was saying if religious authorities would have found it in some way blasphemous, even if it was true, which connects with a saying we we encountered, I can't remember which one it is, where Jesus took Thomas aside when he, you know, gave a really good answer and told him three things aside from everyone else. And Thomas came back and said, and everyone was like, what did he tell you? What did he tell you? What did he tell you? And Thomas is like, if I told you, you would pick up these stones and kill me with them, stoning for blasphemy, and fire would rain down from heaven and kill you, which is the traditional punishment that God has when you have so completely missed his point that you've, you know, gone and killed a prophet or something like that. Not that everyone who killed prophets was killed by lightning afterwards. That is not actually true. But that would have been the traditional punishment from God. So, yes, there was a cultural reason.
So these stones will serve you if you listen to my words. Right after he has said, one who is before existing, which could certainly be under these circumstances taken as being a dangerous statement, one who is before existing could ruffle somebody's feathers depending on what they believe.
Right. And so you could understand that in the most culturally acceptable way at the time. That, oh, he's just talking about God. Blessed is the one who is before existing. Yes, okay, he's just talking about God because God made everything. And so God existed before everything else existed. And if he was talking about God, okay, that's a perfectly fine way of referencing what we would consider God the Father and what the Jews would just consider God.
Mm-hmm.
The one, the true, the only God. And so if that is the way he meant us to understand that, it's not too bad. It's not too crazy. If he meant it to be something else, and when he says, if you become my disciples and listen to my words, these stones will serve you. So he's referencing the kind of miracles that he has done. Because one of the ways that you can look at some of his miracles is not only to have power over illness and power over food, and power over death, but he has power over the natural world. And to have power over the natural world, you know, calming waves, walking on water, these are power over natural world. That is a godlike attribute. And it might not have seemed to the good Jews at the time, oh, that means he's God. No, it would have meant God gave him one of God's own powers to prove to us that he was really sent from God. And so him telling them, if you become my students and listen to what I'm saying, and presumably not just listen, but deeply listen to know it in your bones, these stones will serve you. He's talking about the kind of godlike abilities to be the master over the natural world. And that might have been fighting words right there for the Jewish authority.
Is this why Martin Luther chose evergreens for Christmas trees?
No. That has to do with co-opting the existing pagan rituals, which Christianity is very good at doing.
Yes.
Christianity will come into a region and say, and Christian missionaries will get to know what the people do, how they worship, what their rituals are, who they consider God. they will get to know that as well as they possibly can. And then they will explain that culture and that region's whole religion, which has, let us be clear, nothing to do with Jesus. And they will explain, oh, the high God you worship is God the Father. We call that God this. And the ritual that you have in the middle of winter, it's so wonderful because we have the same ritual and ours looks like this. And very early on, one of the things they would do, they wouldn't just say, your ritual is just like our ritual. We just call it this thing and we do it this way. But they would incorporate aspects of that other ritual of the land that they're going into and trying to proselytize and say, this is fantastic. You have the same ritual that we have. We'll use part of your ritual elements in our ritual, and it will make you feel like you've always been doing this. And there is a way where we can understand, okay, well, if there really is only one God, there is only one creator of all things, and I worship that creator in my way, and you worship that creator in a totally different way, okay, we can just acknowledge, hey, we're worshiping the same creator God, just in different ways. Except missionaries are not known for being particularly respectful, which you probably already know, but just in case you were at all unsure, they're not known for being super respectful for the cultures in which they are trying to proselytize. And they often end up steamrolling over them, incorporating one or two elements or aspects of that culture, and then discounting as much as possible and just replacing it with Jesus. Now, do I think Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life? I sure do. Do I think that that gives any Christian missionary license to steamroll over other cultures? I really don't.
What about the stones? Could that be a kind of a reference to Moses getting water out of the stone?
Yes, absolutely. And it is a reference to water, Moses getting water out of a stone, because that's how we understand in the whole kind of the whole line of prophets that have come before. They've all had some kind of God-given power, whether it's to heal the sick or raise the dead or power over nature or power over food, which is, you know, power over starvation and scarcity. They all have something that can identify them, or at least most of them do. And, you know, Moses is the first prophet that the Jewish people had. Not considered the greatest prophet, but the first prophet. And so, you know, God gave Moses power over the waters crossing the Red Sea. God gave Moses power over the sun to keep it from setting while they were crossing the Red Sea. God gave Moses power over the rock when he struck it and water flowed out. God took away powers from Moses when Moses struck the rock too many times because he was so pissed off. And, you know, Moses prayed and God gave the people manna in morning and night and doves in the evening to kill and eat. And so Moses also had power over scarcity and starvation. Definitely didn't have powers of navigation, but, you know, had many of the powers that are attributed to God at that time and were offered as a gift to not just to help the people, though it obviously helped the people in the Exodus, but later on to give a kind of verification. Because as I've said before, possibly other places, if someone says they're a prophet of God, you can't just like Google them. You can't look them up on Yelp and see if they've got a 5-star rating as a prophet of God. You have to either wait and see if what they've said comes true, because that is absolutely a way to figure out, is this prophet really from God? Well, I don't know. Let's wait and see. Or if they can actually perform miracles, that means they're from God. And whether or not we think, yes, miracles can really happen, or meh, miracles, I don't know. They were a gullible people from long ago. Who knows? That matters less than what the culture thought at the time. And we always have to read these ancient texts and try to understand, how did the people at the time understand them? Because that will help to inform how we need to understand them. And so part of what Jesus is saying in saying 19 is, if you become my students and really take in what I'm saying, other people will recognize that you too are sent from God. Further thoughts, comments, concerns?
The five trees in paradise, when you read the commentary, don't seem to have anything to do with trees.
Yeah, Jesus does that sometimes, doesn't he? Like the mustard seed and the mustard bush really didn't have much to do with mustard.
And if you see mustard in the fields, it is not tree-like.
No.
As I look at it, it almost seems as though these trees produced something to eat. And so if you got familiar with these particular trees, you would have food.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
That's a possibility. You know, yeah, looking at the commentaries that I'm glancing at now. Yeah. The trees at best seem to be a metaphor. What they are actually a metaphor of is something we could argue about for a long time.
Hmm.
What are other references in the Bible to trees of something beside the tree of life?
You know, the mustard plant, does he call it a tree or does he call it a great bush? You know, I think that depends on the translation.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's the tree of life. There's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Those are both in the same story in Genesis. In the Psalms, there's lots of references to trees, particularly cedars of Lebanon, and different trees in the Psalms are usually referenced with the feeling of either strength, you know, the strength of a big, strong tree, or wealth, in the idea that you have access to such great resources as trees, because remember, they're desert people.
The desert, yes.
And so to be able to build with trees in the desert is a luxury that not everybody gets to have.
Well, the carpenter, so he used trees.
Mm-hmm.
He's familiar with trees.
And he clearly was not a carpenter for, you know, his own class of people.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been Caesarea Maritima, I think, is nearby to where he was. And anyway, there was a city that Rome was building or rebuilding about the time when Jesus was kind of between 15 and 30. And so it would have required carpenters, it would have required stonemasons, and it was within walking distance. It was between 2 and 6 miles away. And so it's very likely that he was an artisan who worked in that city rebuilding something beautiful for the Romans for most of his adult life before he started his ministry. Because, you know, his adult life would have begun about at puberty. 12 or a little bit later. Thinking of the presence of other trees. I'm not thinking of any off the top of my head. Grace, do you remember any?
In the Bible?
Yeah, references to trees.
Yeah, they were the... I'm trying to remember, because there are trees that we don't have around here, and that's why I can't I remember the...
I mean, there's some references to the use of wood, but that's not quite a tree. You know, they tell you what the ark was made out of, the Ark of the Covenant and Noah's Ark. They tell you what... There weren't many trees used made in the building of Solomon's temple. It was mostly stone. But if there were any trees used at any point in time, there would be a description of it.
But he specifically mentioned evergreens. The leaves do not fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't change between summer and winter.
Yep. And is he speaking, and think of the climate that evergreens grow in.
Palm tree.
It could be palm trees. Think of the fact that it's a desert. And if we're not talking palm trees, the trees he would have had personal knowledge of, it's either palm trees, maybe cedars of Lebanon, because they're mentioned in the Psalms, and a good Jew would have most, if not all, of the Psalms memorized in song form. Or he's talking about a mystical tree that is kind of ever new and never shifts or changes. Not, strictly speaking, an evergreen, which is only going to happen in colder climates. And definitely no pine trees in a desert.
Oh, olive trees and dates grow on trees?
Dates grow on trees.
Okay, dates and olives. Mm-hmm. Olives were quite common.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and when in some of the stories where he was telling parables about trees that didn't fruit and pruning them.
Yes. The fig trees, mm-hmm.
Fig.
And I'm thinking of the tree of Jesse, where they refer to the house of David in 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, as and later in the Psalms, yeah. As a tree.
Mm-hmm. A family tree, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the family tree type thought could be evergreen, because as long as a family has offspring, it's evergreen.
And that actually, as a metaphor, goes really well with the next line. Whoever knows them will not taste death.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaves of that family tree do not fall.
And that was kind of the promise from Abraham, right through, you know, Abraham and Sarah, and then later David with Solomon and his throne. And so that was kind of a loop of thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also he said these trees are in paradise, so they wouldn't even necessarily be familiar with the kind of trees that they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this commentary down in the towards the bottom of the page, it says Kafka said, so of course it's not biblical, but Kafka said, paradise is still here. It is we who were thrown out of it. In order to rediscover it, we must know the five trees that do not change from summer to winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives lots of room for thought and discussion.
It does. And, you know, even though Lelou is quoting Kafka here in the first portion and then kind of using the quote to his own ends in the second portion, he's actually following a millennia old tradition that started in, the turn of the last millennia, let us say, where the primary Christian, Muslim, and Jewish thinkers of the Western world all started doing something very different. And they started doing this very different thing because Plato and Aristotle had been rediscovered. And it was the beginning of what the Christians call the scholastic period. But it actually had, there was synergy in the great thinkers, the great religious thinkers of all the Western world in all the Abrahamic faiths, because not only was Plato and Aristotle rediscovered, they were translated into Arabic and into Latin, and they were disseminated. And so what then happened was that religious theologians from all these three traditions started not just answering tricky questions about how to live life and tricky questions about morality, that the Bible either, it was debatable, it was something we argued about, or the Bible, or, you know, the Quran or the Tanakh was just silent on the matter. So like the holes in the religion, like how do we fill in the holes, or the things that we argue about? And so they started shifting from making arguments based only on the Holy Scripture itself, you know, whether you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish, the Holy Scripture that you have, and the previous decisions that religious leaders in your religion had made. So the previous decisions of the councils and the conventions and the Pope, you know, for Christianity. And they started introducing the concept of reason and rationality and the logical proof, because a logical proof came in back into vogue, as it were, and back into awareness with Plato and Aristotle. And if you have the sort of mind that is linear in nature, once you have been introduced to the concept of a logical proof, you can't unsee it. And so in Christianity, I don't have all the names memorized for the Muslim movement and the Jewish movement, and I apologize for that. But in Christianity, it started with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Lanfranc, and then it continued with the next Archbishop of Canterbury, Anselm. And then it also continued with Peter Abelard, who was not an Archbishop of Canterbury, but, you know, he made great strides. And they were all theologians and rationalists and logicians. And it's a beautiful thing to see. And Anselm was considered the foremost logician of the Middle Ages. And this guy, God bless him, he deduced from logic alone, not even using the Bible, the existence of God. And it still stands as a logical proof, because logic is logic. It still makes a certain amount of rational sense. And it's fascinating stuff. But we have been doing this for 1,000 years, looking at our religion and using not just the Bible, but also using our rational brain to try to puzzle things out, and borrowing from philosophers who spend their entire lives trying to be rational about things. And so in that way, Lelou is really just in a long line of rational theologians who are trying to sort out deep questions. And that is your lesson on scholasticism. Not everybody was excited about scholasticism, by the way. The mystics were particularly upset because they were perfectly fine with holding intuition and revelation as the most important and the most reliable way of understanding God. But not everybody's a mystic. And so for all the people who weren't mystics, it was nice to be able to get a handle on things. Let's move on to saying 20. Marilyn or Sue, would you like to read out saying 20 for us?
Sure.
All right, Marilyn.
Okay. The mustard plant, that's the explanation. The disciples said to Jesus, "Tell us what the kingdom of heaven is like." And he said to them, "It is like a mustard seed. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it falls on tilled soil, it produces a great branch and becomes shelter for birds of the sky."
All right, let's let that sink in for a moment or two of silence. What do you think of saying number 20?
Well, I've always thought that it referred to our brains and our hearts being the tilled field, and the teachings were the seeds. So if we had a properly tilled field, the seeds would blossom and grow, and we would be stronger. And if our brain and hearts were not either completely or properly tilled or taught or whatever, it would have trouble developing.
We don't generally think of the kingdom of heaven as something that changes. We think, oh, we're going to heaven and it's going to be like so, and that's the way it's going to be forever. But this would lead you to believe that it starts out one way and grows and changes with time, as time is understood later on.
Mm-hmm. There is an argument that says the kingdom of heaven isn't something out there. It's something in here. It's not something when you die, or at least that's not the aspect that Jesus was talking about. It's something that is within you that can grow and blossom and become freaking amazing. And, you know, and Jesus has a lot of "the kingdom of heaven is like" sayings. He's got a lot of sayings that start with that phrase. And some of them are tiny things that become large things. Some of them are lost things that become found things. Some of them are moments where a person sees one small thing worth more than anything else they have. And so they go and sell everything else they have. And so there are themes here. What is lost is found. What is small is important. What seems to be small at first becomes huge and overwhelming in a good way. And he has other sayings that aren't quite, they don't start the kingdom of heaven is like necessarily, at least I don't think, but they are in the same line as his, the kingdom of heaven is like parables. And, you know, the parable of the prodigal son is one. And here we have a really intense story with lots and lots of detail about a son that goes and squanders his inheritance. And remember that prodigal doesn't mean returning son. Prodigal means squandering son. And so the squandering son wastes every gift he's given, but is welcomed back with huge amounts of joy. And the kingdom of heaven is like that too.
In that context, wouldn't our feelings when we hear that possibly Hitler and Nazis could be in heaven, and we have to deal with that, we're like the son that stayed home and did all the right things, and Hitler comes in like the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm. And yet when I think in my own life, and I think about people who have wronged me, honestly, the greatest hope that I have for them is that they can somehow, some way in this life, figure out that they hurt people and stop doing it and just live a better life. And I know that I'm not, the hurt that they gave me is not going away just because they changed their mind. And the wounds that I tend are up to me to heal now. They're not up to them. You know, but I don't hope for them to roast in hell forever because they hurt me. I hope for them to find deep, true happiness someday, because I know that they are not happy right now. And the fact that they're miserable SOBs doesn't actually give me comfort. It's sad and pathetic.
I always end up going back to the three words, God is love. And I think that the kingdom of God and the kingdom of love, it's all, if not one, it's certainly tied together. And it is something that grows, like love grows over time and changes and can start out in a small way and grow to something extremely large. And I just think it's very tied up together, or the same thing.
Yeah. I've often considered that peace, joy, and love, we see them as very different kinds of emotions, kinds of states of being. But I often wonder if peace, joy, and love, which I would say are the three fundamental positive emotions, and that every other positive emotion is some variation, it's some description of how much peace you have, how much joy you have, how much love you have, and where you're expressing it, and how you're expressing it, and to whom you are expressing it, that peace, joy, and love are actually the same thing to God. And we separate it out because we like to put names on things. But that it's actually the same essence of what God is. God is peace, joy, love. And we can have peace, joy, love because we are from God. That is God's primary gift to us.
I think the word of God gives you those three things, peace, love, and joy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I know if I have a problem, that's where I go, right to my Bible. And that gives me peace and joy and love.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful.
I think the fruits are really all apples. It's just that some are Crispins, some are Northern Skies, and some are delicious.
Well put. Well put, Marilyn. Well, let's move on to saying 21, as saying 20 is rather familiar to us. Saying 21 may not be. Sue, do you want to read this one?
Mary asked Jesus, "What are your disciples like?" He answered, "They are like little children who have gone into a field that does not belong to them. When the owners return and say, 'Give us back our field,' they will remove their clothes and see themselves naked before the owners and leave the field to them. This is why I say, if the master of the house knows that a thief is coming, he will be vigilant and not allow the thief to break into the house of his kingdom or carry off his goods. Thus, you should be vigilant toward the world. Strengthen yourself with great energy, or the thieves will find a way to get to you. The prophet that you are counting on will be found by them. May there be a wise person among you. When the crop is ripe, he comes immediately and harvests it with his sickle. Those who have ears, let them hear."
All right, let's let that one sink in for a moment or two of silence. What do you make of saying 21?
Well, I think it's saying you better repent and be ready for the return of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what the vigilance is talking about. Yeah. What else do you notice? It's a pretty long saying. It's got a lot in there.
What is the reference about taking off your clothes to give the field back? I don't get it. Am I missing something?
Yeah, you are. So am I. I apologize. I don't know the full background. Pardon me. I don't know the full background of this particular reference. I do know that nudity wasn't as absolutely banned, at least for men and possibly for children, as it was in our culture. For instance, fishermen tended to take their clothes off while fishing. And we've got a reference from that. Because right there at the end of the Gospel of John, which we just recently heard in church, Peter was out fishing with the guys and Jesus was on the shore after his resurrection. And when they finally figured out, it's the master, he's on the shore, Peter put his clothes back on because he was naked, and it's right there in the Gospel of John. Mm-hmm. So fishing naked was apparently a thing that at least sometimes happens. It's ironic to me that he puts his clothes on and then jumps in the water, which these days it would be like, no, take off some layers first, then jump in the water. And it's exactly the opposite. So that's culture for you. Yeah, a bit different from how the Middle East is now.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, really, really very different. But more than that, I apologize. I don't know.
Well, the strengthen yourself with great energy, or the thieves will find a way to get to you, strikes me as telling us to learn the truths and the rightness of what Jesus has taught through the centuries. Strengthen ourselves with those teachings, with his teachings. and learn them and be ready, because the thieves will find a way to get to us. And to me, that's all the untruths, the all these crazy conspiracy theories and all this other stuff. One way or another, the thief will find us and we'll lose what we once thought we had. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but that's how it hit me. However, I don't see how the prophet that you are counting on will be found by them. As, you know, it's like being robbed, but our truths, you can't rob them, we'll give them to you. So to me, that doesn't make sense. That part of, I don't know how to make sense out of that. We lost our host.
Yeah,
I'm coming back. I'm here. I'm so sorry. The laptop died. I had to plug it in real quick. Sue was about to make a fantastic point. I apologize. Can you start again?
I don't know that it was fantastic. I'm confused. So the strengthening yourself with great energy, or the thieves will find a way to get to you, said to me that we have to learn and study and take in, making it our own, as much of the teachings of Christ as we can do for ourselves with God's help. But then it says, the prophet that you are counting on will be found by them. The prophet that you are counting on, to me, that would seem like salvation and paradise. And it will be found on them. Well, fine. We would give it to them. I mean... We're not trying to hoard it. We're trying to share it. But if they try to steal, like I guess I had said something to the effect of the truths and that them trying to come in and take what we have, the conspiracy theories, the lack of truths, the all these hateful things that keep upending our societies with falsehoods. So if we hold on to the truths and they find us, well, that's good. We would like them to find us. So I don't see the negative aspect of that.
They you can, said, are keeping yeah. arms in your house against potential robbers.
I think he probably wasn't speaking about keeping knives and swords in your house against potential robbers. But that is a fine literal reading of it. Sue, I think you've hit on a beautiful kind of one step farther than where Jesus's students were interpretation that's right in line with Grace's interpretation. And that is, you know, we need to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the lessons that Jesus has given us so that we can work out our own salvation between us and God. Hold fast to the truth that we are coming to understand Jesus was trying to nudge us to. And then when someone else comes along, share it with them. Now, a kind of negative interpretation of this, not negative meaning bad, but negative meaning, protect yourself from the thieves at night kind of interpretation would be, so you're trying to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest these deep truths that are hard to learn. They're hard to practice. It's hard to love your enemies. And really, if it was easy, it wasn't something Jesus told us to do. Jesus only gave us the hard stuff to do. And so as we are trying to do this the best we can and failing day by day, there can be the temptation to give up. The temptation to say, well, it's okay if I hate that enemy, if I do a pretty good job on these ones over here. It's okay if I, you know, forgive all of these things, but I'm going to reserve this particular hatred right over here, and I'm not going to forgive that. You can't make me forgive that, God. Okay, yeah, you're right. God can't make you forgive that, but it's a temptation to hate. It's a temptation that God's not giving us. The devil is the one who tempts. And so if you want to read it in the negative, the thief that comes in and steals isn't people. It's temptation to do all the wrong things, all the things that we had the proclivity to do before we realized, oh, you mean God really is love? As Marilyn reminds us often. Oh, you mean the point is loving our neighbor? Like all the time? Like all the time? And it's not that, okay, now we're worried that our neighbors are going to come in and steal. I think Jesus is using that as a metaphor because he's done that in the Gospels before. You know, if the householder knew at what time the thieves were planning on coming, everybody would be up and armed. And that's the kind of thing. If you knew tomorrow exactly what time temptation was going to befall you, would you be ready? Think of it in a different way. If you knew tomorrow that you were going to get into a car accident, would you drive more safely? Would you say, you know what? Never mind. I don't need to drive tomorrow. She's like, you know what? I'm just going to put off my errands. It's fine. It's fine. If you knew tomorrow that something you were going to say was going to accidentally hurt someone that you love, would you be more vigilant in your speech? This is the kind of thing that Jesus means when he says, if the householder knew at what time the thieves were coming, everyone would be vigilant and awake. And so if we knew at what time temptation was going to strike us to be careless in our physical world, or to be just momentarily thoughtless in our speech, to hurt someone else physically or emotionally, would we be more vigilant?
I like the part where it says, let there be among you a person who understands, because it, to me, that's saying, don't try to do it all yourself. Reach out to other people for understanding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is easy to go astray when we just think all the time with people who think exactly the way we think. And I know I use the word think a little too many times there, but when we're in an echo chamber of our own thoughts, even surrounded by other people, it can get a little crazy. And we can start to think things that are perhaps not good because nobody's challenging us. Nobody's asking us, is that loving? Do we think that that's loving? Are we sure that that's the right way? And it doesn't matter who we are. It doesn't matter what kind of politics we espouse. It doesn't matter who we vote for. We're human beings. And we're all capable of getting derailed especially when people only say, oh, yes, yes, I agree with you. And on that note, it is 11 o'clock, my friends. I apologize for my technical snafu. I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen again. And we will pick up next time at Logion 22. Make sure. Yep. Thank you so much for coming. It was wonderful to talk with you and hear all of your fantastic observations and opinions on the crazy Gospel of Thomas. And I hope you have a very wonderful week. Stay safe.
Thank you. See you.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.